Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History at Marvelia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. We're live from the All News Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. And I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American foul game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150 plus years of football history and memorabilia. You find us on the web app. GridironGreatsMagazine.com. It's at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larger. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires, Joe. Welcome to the show this evening.
Captain, how are you, sir? So good to be back talking hobby with you.
We're back and we're in a quasi new location in Southport. We're in the condo waiting for the new compound to be finished down here. And hopefully we'll be in the new house the middle of November, end of November. And I'll be set up again at full strength, to say the least. Very different way of life down here. I'm very, very, very happy being down here. Brenda and I have
it's pretty cool.
I've never been called sir as many times as I have in my life since I've been here. It's amazing. Truly amazing. But let's get in. It's been a few months since we've talked. Let's get right into the topic of the evening before a special guest comes on, and that will be the National Sports Collectors Convention and a few things that you've picked up the past few months. I can't wait to hear this, and I do send my apologies out for not being able to attend the National this year. There's way too much going on. And I will be back next year. Ironically, it's up out of, I guess, Atlantic City, which would have been a four-hour drive for me from Wallingford, but obviously it's going to be a little longer trek this coming year. So, Jim, I'm handing off to you, and let's roll me in.
Well, Captain, very sorely missed, obviously. You know, just what a great event. I only went into the National, the actual, and walked the grounds of the National one day, and that was Friday. I mean, maybe that surprises you, but it's I really go down there just to hang out with, you know, hobby friends and people, and that's what I love. I went down with my son, Xander. You know, he's 12 years old. It's his second National. He went to the Cleveland one 3 years ago. Even he knows the guys. We went to the VFC pizza dinner on Thursday night, or as he called it, the Leatherheads. All the group of the Leatherheads. You know, Jeff Payne put together a really nice pizza dinner. Probably 25 people there. We ripped a little bit of lax. You know, Mike Blaisdell challenged him to eat the gum from the wax, and Xander did. It was kind of funny.
Wow.
Just a really good Leatherhead pizza. And I think Jeff FaceTimed you from that. Weather was pretty bad where you were, so it was kind of choppy. But I remember him, you know, passing the phone around, FaceTiming the captain. You had to. There is no Leatherhead gathering without you. So I thought that was very classy of him.
I was very honored for Jeff to call me there, and I did call from one of the last phone conversations I had from my old man cave back in Wallingford was the National dinner. So it was pretty cool. How was it? I mean, I heard so many stories of pent up demand. Things were flying out of there. Fill me in.
Oh, it. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of interesting. It's just it was one of the most attended Nationals. You know, I think I forget the NSCC threw out a stat, but it was like one of the second most attended National, the most attended in like 30 years. And it was crowded. It was shoulder to shoulder. It was crowded. And so by the time I made it there, you know, Friday at, you know, 9:30 in the morning, 10 a.m. or whenever it opened, I mean, it was already packed. I had to hang out at Josh Adams Sports Cards, your usual stomping grounds, for a little while. You know, hung out at Al Crisafulli's booth. He had a nice table set up there too. You know, love of the game. But I'm not a big fan of crowds. I don't like, you know, bumping and touching, especially in time of COVID. So I walked the halls. I bought stuff. I bought some unopened wax from BBCE. Bought an unopened wax pack from another dealer. But, you know, good stuff was scarfed up. I bumped into, you know, a former guest of the show, Scott Alpoff, who now works for PSA. You know, and he said stuff was just flying off the shelves. It was interesting. PSA stopped taking submissions Friday morning. They were there, but they weren't grading. SGC was there, but they weren't grading. They had a double booth, but they were like, no, we're not here to grade. We won't even take submissions. We just wanted to say thank you to everybody. I mean, it was a very odd setup, but, I got a chance to just talk to everybody and walk the floor, but this is the first National I haven't bought that much stuff.
Get back to that PSA, not taking submissions. I had a couple of people ask me about that because they were surprised. And I said, twofold. Number one, if you're going to gain credit, if you're going to continue to be credible in the market, this is my honest opinion, you're not going to offer turnaround time like, you know, of 1 hour to get a card graded type of thing, especially
Absolutely.
When you've just waited a year to get a card graded that you mailed in or whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
So I think they made a very wise move in saying, we'll set up, we'll support the National, we'll support the hobby, we'll say thanks to our customers, but sorry, we're not going to accept anything. I think that was probably the best move they possibly could have made compared to, you know, trying to take it. And you and I both know, we remember seeing the lines there, which were ridiculous over the years, of people trying to drop stuff off and then the next day. You know what I mean? So I think it was And number two, I think they just wanted to take in the first National in 2 years to view what was really going on one way or the other. That's my opinion on what happened. you know.
I couldn't agree more. But apparently, they got flooded with so much, with so many submissions, they stopped taking submissions, except for the, you know, like $1,000 level, or I forget what, a $600 level, where it was, you know, turned around national. I brought probably about a dozen, probably about 18 cards to get graded. And I was prepared to pay $100 a card, but they weren't taking submissions. So I didn't submit a single thing. Brought a couple wax boxes to get looked at, and I didn't submit a single thing. It was just, it was weird. You nailed it on the head. There's that I save for a national to get submitted so that I can submit it and then, you know, 2 days later pick it up. And it was for naught. It's very interesting.
Yep. I hear you.
That was fun. Right. Friday night we had another dinner. Group of guys. You know, it was awesome. It was tiring. You know, Saturday, you know, Xander and I went to Chicago and hung out, had dinner down there, and we took a Chicago River, you know, boat ride up and down the river, which was awesome. It's exactly what we go to the National for, you know, is to meet our friends and to hang out. I mean, how many Nationals have you been to where you got kind of changed to your table, where you don't really have the chance to walk the floor?
Right. And I rarely walk the floor at a National. I mean, I try to, you know, check it out early in the morning before we set up. And honestly, the last National I could say I really walked around was Baltimore, probably in 2010. That was probably the last National I really got a good shot at walking around. And, you know, it's a tough show because, again, depending on where you're coming in from, you're shipping stuff there, you're carrying stuff on the plane, yada, yada, yada. So you don't get a good feel of everything that's going on there one way or the other.
I just could tell this was the National of all Nationals to have missed. And I haven't missed one in many, many years.
And too bad I couldn't make it, but I know it was an incredible National. And a few dealers that I know who I talked to afterwards said that was probably their best show in years. And that was good. It was good for the hobby. And again, the way I look at it, the National is the place to go where you want to find that one card that you've been looking for the past 3 years that you can't find anywhere. You know what I mean?
Yep.
You're looking for a football that you've never
worked, type of thing. And you can say all you want about eBay and online and so on and so forth. When you buy something in person, there's nothing better than that. To actually see it, see
it,
take it out, to feel it, to smell it.
Yep.
Exactly right.
You know, it's our hobby.
I was hanging out at Josh Adams' booth, and I was definitely thinking about, like, you know, it was the first National I've been to where you weren't there, you know. The one in Cleveland 3 years ago, you were sharing a booth with, with BST guys. And then a little before that, Josh Adams. It's weird not seeing you there. And then I started wondering, it's like, how often does Bob get to walk around the National floor, you know, and leave his booth? It got me wondering.
Yep. It's very minimal. I rarely have been able to, in all the years that I've gone to the National and set up, I've never walked the complete area. And even when I attended as a collector, I never got to walk the whole area because I was only there for a day or two. And I was out, type of thing. So I'll be back. I'm getting the itch to do a show again and see a show. I'm very close to Chantilly here. I'm about 6 hours out. So I'm going to be looking into setting up there in the future and getting back into the swing of things. So
very nice.
Quickly pass through your hands. What's going on?
My uncut sheet collection is growing. My love of uncut sheets is growing as more and more, you hear about more and more nefarious things happening in the hobby. you know, yep. autographs, everything you can think of, you know, can be tainted. An uncut sheet can't be doctored. And I'm just digging it. I bought a 1969 Topps uncut sheet that is yep. stunning. The colors on it are beautiful. They alternate yep. rows where one's upside down, so the colors mesh, and it's just the colors on it are beautiful. I got it about a week ago, unrolled it. I'm going to frame it and hang it in my office with the other dozen or so uncut sheets that I have going on. It is so colorful, Bob. I mean, it's a rainbow of colors. It's beautiful. And love it. And then I picked up in the, I think the Heritage Auction, a 1975 Topps, all four sheets. It was the entire set on four uncut sheets. I'm pretty happy
wow.
to take that down. It's pretty cool because I didn't have
wow.
any 1975s. So pretty stoked. Picked
mm-hmm.
up a couple more 1961 Fleer sheets. The most common uncut sheet you find in the hobby, other than when you start getting into the 80s, is 1961 Fleer for some reason. You know, second series, you know, AFL. So I probably own 20 of those sheets. And I don't know why. Every time
oh,
I
wow.
buy one, I'm like, well, this ought to do it. This should be the last one left. Corner of the silver
well,
market.
I always
going to buy them in security.
I go back to the 1980s. I still remember, and I finally sold the rest of what I had probably 6-7 years ago at a national. I would get somehow 10 card strips of 1960 Fleer football, and
yes.
there used to be a local dealer in Connecticut, and he had them, and I bought, traded, whatever from him, and I had probably about 30 or 40 at one time, and over the years I sold them off piece by piece, and I always wondered. I will always assume that was printer scrap and was able to make it out. And it was the same story I heard on the 61 Fleer sheets because I remember he had one or two of those also. But I didn't buy them for whatever reason. I bought the strips. I liked the strips because they displayed very easily, you know what I mean, on the table, so on and
yeah.
so forth. But I'm so shocked at the amount of 61 Fleer sheets out there. It's amazing to me, to say the
yep.
least. So,
yep.
But
yeah, I see there's a strip cut 61 Fleer sheet on eBay right now.
Right.
12 rows of 11. Yeah, I've always wondered who cut that up because 60
yeah.
Fleer is pretty rare. I only have two sheets of that, so it's pretty rare.
Yeah, but I saw those 60 Fleer over the years, and it's amazing to see them and to have but I was never into uncut sheets, and you're the expert on it. And to me, you do have probably one of the largest collections of them in the country, if not the largest collection. Well, seriously, because of what you have.
I wonder, yeah.
Just some incredible finds of seeing rare sheets, 50-plus years old, still in excellent condition.
Yeah.
It amazes me, to say the least. It amazes me.
Yeah.
But
again, Gridiron Greats ask, if anyone knows or has an angle on a 1935 Chickle uncut sheet, you know, please send me a message.
We're looking for Joe's Elusive, 35 National, Chickle. We'll find one day. All right. Our guest is here, and I'll introduce him to our audience tonight. He was born in 1946, and our guest went to his first Los Angeles Rams football game in 1956 when he was with his Cub Scout pack. He didn't know much about pro football, but the Rams uniform with the Rams horns got him hooked. He's had over 65 articles published, publications such as Baseball Digest and Sports Collectors Digest. He wrote his current book, The Los Angeles Rams, 1949 to 1955, the team that changed the NFL forever, because he wanted fans to know what that team did in those
yep.
years, 1946 to 55. It's at this time I'd like to welcome our special guest, author Rick Van Blair, to our show this evening. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob. It's good to. Thanks for calling me. I appreciate that.
Rex, our pleasure to have you on the show tonight. And I'd like to hand off and lead with this question. How'd you become a fan of the Los Angeles Rams?
Well, I'll never forget it. That was that 1956 game. You know, the Cub Scouts, I was in the Cub Scouts, and we went here and we went there. And then one time they said, oh, we're going to take you kids to the Rams game, a football game. And I didn't know much about football. My dad wasn't into sports. He didn't watch it on TV. He didn't talk to me. So anyway, we went to the game. And, of course, Southern California, it was raining. And so I had a raincoat on, but no coat underneath it. So I was cold during the whole game. And I really, all I knew was one team tried to get the ball over the goal line, and the other team was trying to stop them. And years later, I told my best friend, I said, my gosh, you know what? I had no idea who was down on that field. I had no idea the Crazy Legs Hirsch and Norm Van Brocklin and Johnny Unitas of the Colts, Gino Marchetti, Raymond Berry. I had no idea those guys. Lenny Moore. I remember Lenny Moore, though, because there was one player that had white shoes. He taped his football cleats all the way up over the lace.
Yep.
And I thought, that's strange, you know. But I bought my first pennant, my first Rams pennant, and I still have that today for 75 cents. But when the game ended, you know, I thought, oh, good, we're going to go home so I could get warm. And one of the parents that was with us says, he bought us each a game program. He says, boys, we're going down to the locker room now to get autographs. I did not know what an autograph was. I thought, maybe with something to eat, you know, like a popsicle or something. I had no. I was 10 years old. So we went down there, and we went in down the tunnel and then inside to this long hallway. On the right side was the showers, and then at the end of the hallway was the locker room. And, you know, these Rams are going in there, and I don't know who's who. And then they come down. And they said, hi, boys, how you doing? You know, one at a time or two at a time. Did you like the game? Yeah, yeah. Okay, and then they took our programs and they signed it. I said, oh, that's what an autograph is. So I became a football hound and an autograph hound. But the Ram uniform just knocked me out. It just, those dark yellow jerseys and dark helmets with the huge Ram horns on them. I thought, that is really neat, and I've been a Rams fan ever since.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
You're right. There is no beating those Rams uniforms, the helmets, you know, from the 50s. They're stunning.
You know, Fred Gehrke came up with that. He was an art student at Utah when he was in college. And there's different stories of how it came about, but I read one interview with him. And he said, you know, Dan Reeves, the owner, was always telling us, you know, if you ever have an idea, boys, to how to make the Rams uniform better, just let me know. And so he got thinking, well, you know, they call us the Rams. Why not, you know, so he drew out a, you know, on a piece of paper, a helmet with horns on it. He showed it to his coach. It was Bob Snyder then. And Snyder goes, hey, I don't know what you're talking about. He goes, here, take this leather helmet home. And this is 1947. And so he took it home, painted it blue, and then painted the horns, the yellow horns on it. And he took it back and showed it to Dan Reeves, the owner. And Dan Reeves just went crazy. He goes, oh, my God, this is fantastic. Here, Fred, here's 70 helmets. Take them home.
Wow.
Take them home and paint them. During the season had just ended. He goes, take him home. And he goes, oh, my God, what have I done? You know, but anyway, some of the guys on the Rams, his fellow players, went over and helped him. You know, they would paint him blue, and then Fred would do the horns. But, of course, the next year, when they came out in 1948 for that first preseason game against the Redskins, the fans went crazy. They just went crazy. They didn't know this was coming, you know. And they cheered for like 5 minutes. And what I think what it said to the fans in the stands was, hey, this isn't the Cleveland Rams that moved a couple years ago. These are our Los Angeles Rams. And that was neat. That was great.
You know, that's an excellent point. That's an excellent point, Dick, because when you say they're now the L.A. Rams, they're not the Cleveland Rams anymore. They're the first team that ever actually had a visual helmet other than, you know, that actually had team colors or a logo on it, so on and so forth. I mean, it was just incredible to see, to actually see that. That's amazing, to say the least. So I fully get that as far as being an amazing part of Rams history, to say the least, you know.
And, you know, a lot of people thought that the next two teams that put a logo on their helmet were the Colts and, what was that other team? The Colts put the horseshoes on the back of their helmet.
Right.
They had blue helmets
right.
for a couple of years there in the 50s. And then, of course, they went for the white helmets with it on the side. But and then the Eagles, that's right. The Eagles put the wings.
It
didn't happen overnight. It took about, I think, 5 or 6 years before they finally did that in the mid-50s. So, but now they all have it except the Cleveland Browns, which is fine. How do you – one player on the Browns in the 50s says, if they put that little brownie on our helmet, I'm quitting. I'm quitting the team. I'm not going to play with a helmet on with that little stupid brownie on it. But, of course, they never did.
I've always wondered that.
Yeah.
Kind of a side question, Rick, if you don't mind. This is Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Hearing you say, you know, move from, you know, Cleveland to L.A., I mean, the Rams, other than the Raiders, are one of those teams that have bounced around quite a bit. I mean, you said 56 was that first game you went to, you became a fan. How was it, you know, when they moved out of, you know, L.A., you know, and moved to St. Louis and now back and stuff? Do you are they your team forever, no matter what city, or are they your city's, your favorite team because they're in a city?
Yes, they were still my team, but it was hard to get over. I mean, I didn't sit down and cry, of course, but I think
it's okay.
Dick Horner.
You're among friends, if you did.
Dick Horner, I interviewed him about that time for Sports Collectors Digest, and he was not happy. He said a lot of words that I couldn't, when I wrote up, you know, the interview for Sports Collectors Digest, I couldn't use some of the words that he used when I was interviewing him about what's her name, you know, that, it was like, you know, even Paul Hornung came out and said, you know what, she murdered Carol Rosenbloom. He came right out and said that. He goes, Carol Rosenbloom hated to swim. He had a tremendous fear of water. Why would he be going out in the evening, out in the surf? She had him knocked off. I'm going, whoa.
Wow.
But, yeah, Paul Hornung said that. Of course, you can't get Paul now. He's passed away. But, it sort of, my spirit sort of diminished the 20 years they were away, but I was glad to see him come back. I really was. I think they should be in Los Angeles, and they got a great stadium now. So things are looking good. But you know, I'm old. I'm 75, going on 12. So. I don't get upset too much if they lose. I don't like it, but you know I just go, well, that's football. It's the way it goes. That's sports.
So another odd question, but you know 2000, you know that you know the greatest show on turf, you know that Super Bowl win with Kurt Warner, you know, in the St. Louis Rams. Do you consider that a Rams Super Bowl, or do you consider that that was
of course they were still the Rams. I mean, they could have moved to Egypt and played there, and there would still be the Rams. Of course, that's pretty far away, isn't it? But that's a little humor on my part. My wife still doesn't understand my humor, I tell you. But anyway, it was still the Rams, yeah. But it would have been nicer if it would have been Los Angeles. You know, they were still drawing fans in Anaheim like crazy. Everything was fine.
Yeah.
But she was from St. Louis, and she saw a lot of money, I think, if she moved back there. And, you know, they refused her a couple times. The NFL said no. And then when the Raiders,
right.
I think then Davis said he was going to move, or the Raiders has already moved to Los Angeles. So they thought, Los Angeles has the Raiders. Okay, go ahead, leave town. And then the Raiders left town, and whoa, I'm telling you. But, it was still the Rams. The thing, the thing that bugs me is the younger generation only talk of Super Bowl, Super Bowl, Super Bowl. Like the world didn't begin until the first Super Bowl when the Packers and the Chiefs played. And I'm going, what about the champ? Oh, those don't count. I said, what do you mean they don't count? That was the National Football League championship game. Are you kidding me?
You don't find that attitude on this show, Rick.
That's right.
I think Bob and I have spent more time talking about the 1958 championship, the greatest game ever played versus Super Bowls. So.
Right. I missed that game. My parents went to the mountains. There was a family across the street, the Mahoneys. They moved from Green Bay, Wisconsin, and they used to take. Of course, the Packers always came to. They played the Rams twice, and when they came to L.A., they always drive down, and that's before all the freeways. We had a few freeways, but not that many, and we go down and watch the Packers. And I used to feel sorry for them because, they were so bad then. But now I don't know what the heck I was going to say, what point I was trying to make. But, go ahead.
Okay. Well, writing a book is not easy. And it's always fascinated me just the process that some people go through, how they write a book. I mean, where you start, formulating the chapters, topics, et cetera. Tell us how you did it. I mean, because your book, the team that changed, the NFL, I mean, really cool subject, and obviously lived through it. But, how do you start putting that together? What's your process?
The reason, you got to have a reason for writing a book, number one. The reason I wanted it is because all these years I've been hearing about the great teams in the NFL. And what a great history. What a great history. I wish more young people would read about the history of the National Football League. It's really fascinating. The players, the coaches, the owners, everything. But I just keep hearing about the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Miami Dolphins and the 49ers and then the Browns, the dreaded Browns in the 1950s. God, they were tough. And I thought, very few books on the Rams. No one talks about the Rams. And, of course, I know why. I'm not an idiot. They got to the championship game in 1949, 1950, 1951, just missed it in 52, and then finally came back in 55. And the sad part of it is, for Ram fans anyway, they only won one in 1951. And, they lost to the Eagles, and then they lost a heartbreaker to the Browns. And so that's why they're not. I just wanted people to know about this team. So what I did, I started reading everything I could get a hold of. What books were written about them, and NFL books, of course. You just get an NFL history book, and you're going to get some stuff. But what I didn't know was the contribution that Dan Reeves – the guy was unbelievable. He was just, as a kid, I didn't know he was doing all these things. I didn't know that, I knew he moved him from Cleveland, but I didn't know he had set up the first, he was the first scouting system year-round he set up for the Rams. No other team had that.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable, but they used to go to the draft, other teams, with, maybe somebody would call in and say, you ought to check this guy out that's playing so-and-so. He's pretty good. Maybe you want to draft him. And it was no real scouting system. They'd take a copy of Street and Smith's football magazine every year and look through it. Really? I mean, even the one guy with the Chicago Cardinals front office said, yeah, we saw this picture of this guy jumping up in the air, the usual photograph, you know, and he looked so good. We thought, okay, we'll draft him. Of course, he was a flop, but it's incredible. He got Eddie Cotto, who used to play football for the Packers in the 20s. He was his full-time scout, and half of the year was spent on the road. And he went to big colleges, but small schools also. Also, all black schools. No other NFL team wanted really anything to do with black players. They really didn't want him on their team. But not Dan Reeves. They got Tank Younger from Grambling. Tank Younger, he finished one game in his junior year, and this guy comes up to him. And Tank's tired, you know. He was out there rushing all over the place. He's tired. He wants to take a shower. And he says, Paul, there's somebody at the door wants to talk to you. And he goes, well, tell him I'll talk to him after I get my shower. And he goes, no, this guy's a white man. And he goes, what? What is a white man doing at Grambling anyway? So Tank went out and opened the door, and he goes, hi, I'm Eddie Cotto of Los Angeles Rams. You know, I just want you to know we're keeping an eye on you. You're a great player, and would you consider, playing for the Rams? And, of course, Younger's going, well, yes, of course I would. Okay, we'll keep an eye on you. We'll be in touch. Shook his hand and left. But he did. He went to it was just unreal. I just couldn't get over everything Dan Reeves did. I mean, the first full scouting and you know, the other and one person asked Dan Reeves one time, he says, What's the key to the success of the Rams? And he said, You draft the best players and then get good coaches to bring the best out of them. And that's what they did. It was unbelievable. But he was just unreal. Wow. I just wanted people to know about the he did. Well, you know, when he brought the Rams out, that made the National Football League coast to coast, a real National Football League. And they voted them down at first. They said, that's too far to go. That was like going to Siberia, Russia. You're going to move the team where? Los Angeles, California. Chicago was the farthest west that the NFL went then. And, of course, you know, they'd fly then. They said, we it would cost us too much. So they voted him down. And Dan got really mad and said, you call this a National Football League. He says, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to sell the team. I'm going to disband it. Well, Bert Bell did not want that. They already lost the Brooklyn Football Dodgers to the All-America Football Conference. So they couldn't lose another team. And so they talked for about a couple hours, and then they called Dan back in, and they said, you know, when a visiting team goes to another, they pay him $10,000. They said, would you pay us $15,000 if we came out west, when we come out west to play the Rams? And Dan said, yes. And so that was that. The move was on. Then they had to get into the Coliseum. If they didn't get into the Coliseum, they were dead in the water. And so Dan Reeves, being the very intelligent man he was, talked to the owner of the Washington Redskins and said, would you come out to the West Coast every year for the first preseason game, the Redskins, and play the Rams? And all the money will go to children's charities, hospital. And he said, yeah. And so when the Coliseum Commission didn't want a professional team in Los Angeles, in the Coliseum, they had USC and UCLA. And yeah. But when they came, when it was Walsh, who was the general manager then, and he said, "Well, are you gonna draft black players?" And he said, "Yes, we are. We're gonna sign Kenny Washington, and we're gonna sign some other black players."
Yep.
But when they did that children's charity thing, That just shocked the Coliseum Commission, because if they had said no, they know the next day the headlines would say Coliseum Commission says no to sick and needy children. And of course, yeah. they didn't want that, so they okayed the deal. Yeah. And then they also okayed the All America Football Conference, Los Angeles Dons, to play in the Coliseum also. But Dan Reeves did so much. I mean, he was the first assigned black player since 1933, which made other teams sign black players. He was the first to hold annual charity game. He was the first one to televise home games. And that was, I believe that was in 1950. And even the people who worked for Dan in the front office said, "Are you nuts? You're going to lose all kinds of, we can't do that. We're going to lose, we're already losing money." But see, he had made a deal with Admiral Television saying, if there isn't at least 40,000 people in the stands, you're going to pay us for every empty seat. And they said, okay. So at the end of the year, they paid Dan Reeves over $100,000. Attendance was down. It went down to 20-some-odd thousand for each game. But they got $103,000 back. And this led to other teams the next year. No home games on TV. So the fans had to come out.
Wow.
You know, it was a typical bait, and you know, here you go, here's what we got to sell you. But now it's gone. You're gonna have to come to the games and buy tickets. And you know, in those days tickets were it. And it was just unreal what he did. He did so many things. Free Football for Kids got me in there and us and other kids. He was just so far ahead of everybody else.
Dick, who was your favorite Rams player growing up?
Oh,
if you had one,
Crazy Legs Hirsch. I used to think when I was 10 or 11 years old, I thought I was the only Crazy Legs Hirsch fan, and there was thousands. There was thousands of them, but. You know, I've thought about that. He looked so wonderful in that Ram uniform, running down the field, catching a ball over his head, which very few players could do. And he was on TV sometimes and things like, and my dad did something for me. Maybe he felt guilty for giving me too many spankings when I was little. And also for not taking me to a lot of games. Elroy Hirsch had a restaurant on Ventura Boulevard in the San Fernando Valley. And he said, would you like to go to Crazy Legs Restaurant and meet him there and have dinner? I thought he was kidding. I was 11 years old. I said,
Who asked you that, your dad?
My dad, yeah. And so I said, "Is for real?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I said, "Yeah." So I waited a whole week. It was better than waiting for Christmas. Christmases had nothing on Crazy Legs Hirsch. And finally, my mom and dad and my sister and I, we went to Crazy Legs Restaurant. And he came out in a nice suit, good-looking man, and was so nice. Came over and talked to my parents, talked to me. He said, "Do you play any football, Ricky?" And I said, "Well, just in the front yard, you know, with the other kids." And he goes, "Well, good." And then he said, "Would you like a autographed picture of me?" And I go, "Yeah, I sure would." So he signs a picture I'm looking at right now. It's in my football baseball room.
Wow.
He's flying through the air.
Wow.
He says, "To Ricky, best wishes, Crazy Legs Hirsch." And then always play fair. You know, he wrote that at the bottom. Then we're eating dinner, and he comes over while we're eating dinner, signs our programs for us. It says, "Is the food good? Is everything okay?" "Uh-huh." And then when we're getting ready to leave, he comes up to me again, and he says, "Ricky, is there anything else I can do for you?" And I said, "Well, I noticed some pictures in there was a cocktail lounge on the other side of the restaurant where you eat from, and there was these life-size color pictures of Rams on plastic against the wall, and there were lights behind them. And I had never seen anything like that in my life. And I don't think I've seen too much of that ever again. And I said, well, I'd sure love to go in and look at those. And he said, well, you know, you're supposed to be 21 to go in there, but I think if I go in with you, it'll be okay. So he took me in there and explained all the who was in. Of course, I knew most of the Rams who were in the photos. There was like, oh, I don't know, 8 or 9 or 10 on the wall. And then he told the bartender, he says, show Ricky that ball. And he showed me the first time I've ever held a real National Football League ball in my hands, and it was signed by all the Rams. But you could barely see their signatures because it was in ballpoint pen. But, and I thought, gosh, if I run out of the restaurant right now with this ball, they're going to catch me and put me in jail. So I gave it back to the bartender. But the thought crossed my mind, though. No, he was just, and after games, he would stand there, much to the chagrin of his wife, waiting, you know, for him, and then they'd go out to dinner. He would sign till everybody who wanted an autograph got an autograph. He was just, even years later, I sent him stuff in the mail, a couple pictures of him. You know, could you please sign this and put it in the self-addressed stamped envelope? No problem. That's when he was athletic director at Wisconsin. Then,
oh wow!
I know I talk too much, but then years later, I thought, my gosh, I want to interview him. So I sent him a letter, and sure, call me after such and such. I'll be home then after work. And I called him up, and before I turned on the tape recorder, I said, you know, when I was 11, I saw you at Crazy Lake Restaurant, and I just wanted to thank you.
Cool.
You were just fantastic, and, you know. But he said, well, thank you very much. And then he gave me a great interview. And, you know, all the baseball interviews I did, I finally got around to sending them to the Hall of Fame so they could use them downstairs where writers go to do research and stuff. But I've still held on to the Crazy Lakes Hirsch because it's nice to hear his voice again. But he was just fantastic. And, you know, Van Brocklin said one time of him, he goes, I never saw anybody who loved practice more than Crazy Legs Hirsch. He would just bounce around like there was rubber in his legs. And during practice, he said, he and Waterfield would try to overthrow him, and they barely could do it. Hirsch was that fast. And, you know, just playing around like that, he became the greatest over the shoulder, straight over the head pass catcher.
Absolutely.
In history. But he said they used to practice that. But just a great guy. I was very sad today.
He's so athletic. He was so good looking. I mean, he became a movie star. You know, he was in the right city, you know, L.A., you know, just that Hollywood thing.
Yeah.
Crazy. It's funny. I have a coworker who looks like Elroy Hirsch, and I call him Elroy. I call him Crazy Legs every once in a while.
Uh-huh.
I showed him a picture once. He's like, yeah, I look like Elroy. I'm curious. You said you were just looking at that photo you got from Crazy Legs when you were 11.
Uh-huh.
So obviously you collect. Do you collect any other memorabilia?
You better believe it. I started collecting after that first Rams game in 1956. I came home, and the first chance I got, I went to the library to get every book I could on football in the National Football League. And I brought it home and read and read and read. And I had that Rams pennant that I bought for 75 cents. And that started me. Well, I used to collect baseball cards also, but we never thought they were worth anything except the nickel we paid per pack for them at the liquor store, you know, or at the drugstore. I started collecting pennants. Matter of fact, I've got about 65 pennants on the ceiling. Now, you might think that's strange to put pennants up on a ceiling, but they really look pretty neat. They take up too much room on the walls. And on the walls are all my photographs of, you name them, a lot of Rams, a lot of players I've admired through the years, Bobby Lane, Les Richter, Otto Graham, Johnny Unitas. God, I love Johnny Unitas. I snuck down once in 1965 at the Pro Bowl game. They used to have it in Los Angeles every year. And all the players started going in, you know, after the second quarter had ended. And I said to my friend, I said, you know what? I've got my camera with me. And I'm when the players come out to start the third period, I'm just going to step over this little brick wall, which went up to my belt, and I'm just going to walk behind them. And I did. And they thought, oh, my, you're not going to do that. But I did it. And I walked up. I was about 10 feet in front of Johnny Unitas, and he was sitting on a chair, one of those metal folding chairs next to the bench. And I took a picture of him. I still have that picture. That picture's up on my wall, too.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've got helmets. I've got footballs. I've only have 30 mini helmets. Some people have a lot more. Oh, I know. I've got about 75 pennant, football pennants now, and I know somebody that has 500. So, but, you know, I don't go for numbers. I just go because I love them. They're so fantastic, especially back in those days. My gosh. Oh, so colorful. And it's just, yeah, if ever I get depressed, I just come back here, and it's like magic. Really. It's just like, I'll start looking at, I have a bunch of game programs I've framed. I probably kept the frame business in business. I've got one frame. I've got nothing but Rams football cards from the 50s in it. I wish you could be here right now. Tommy McDonald. I talked to Tommy McDonald after a practice one time in San Fernando in 1965, because I knew he loved Van Brocklin. And I went up to him. I don't know if kids can do this today. I went up to him after practice, and I said, Tommy, tell me about Van Brocklin. And he goes, oh, without him, I'd be nothing. And we stood there for about a half an hour, and he told me, you know what? The Eagles didn't know what to do with me. They said I was too short. He was an All-American in Oklahoma. He said I was too short to be a halfback and too short to be an offensive end. And he says they were going to get ready to either cut me or trade me. And then Van Brocklin came along in 1958 on a last-place Eagles team and said,
nice.
This guy McDonald, don't touch him. He's gonna be my best receiver. And he goes, he turned my career around. He goes, without Van Brocklin, I would have been nothing. Wonderful.
Interesting.
Wonderful.
Wow. That's pretty humbling. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, all this stuff has, I mean, I've got autographed pictures of Jim Parker and Gino Marchetti and Leo Nomellini and Chuck Bednarik. And I got to see all these guys. I'm so lucky because when we would go to a game, especially when I turned 18, I got my first car, a 51 Ford. We could drive down from the San Fernando Valley about 25, 30 miles to the Coliseum, and we'd always go back for autographs, always. And
that's cool.
Gosh, it was so much fun. I have some great memories, you know.
We're getting close to being almost out of time. I want to combine two questions for you. Number one, how can our readers and listeners purchase your book? And I used to write for Sports Collectors Digest back in 89 to 92. When did you used to write for them? I'm curious.
I can't remember the first, Tom Mortensen. Do you remember Tom Mortensen? He was the
editor.
Okay,
yeah, I know Tom. Yeah.
Let's see. I wrote the book "Dug Out the Foxhole," which was interviewed with that I did for Sports Collectors Digest, and they ranged from, you know, like guys like Dick Bartel, Mace Brown, Harry Kraft, Harry Danning, Harry the Horse
yep.
Danning. What a character he was. I could talk for hours about that guy. Boo Ferris, Harry Gumbert, Ernie Coy, Bob Kuzawa, saved two World Series for the Yankees. Buddy Lewis, what a sweetheart of a guy. He was there on Lou Gehrig Day. He said everybody was crying when Lou gave that speech. Joe Nuxall, Johnny Pesky, what a sweetheart. But, the book came out in 94, so I think I started doing interviews probably in 88, 89. I don't
okay.
know. I've got
yeah.
them.
Okay.
I've got them all here, but I can't. They're all stacked up behind this rocking chair I'm sitting in. But, Tom Morton,
no problem.
I went to a the only national I've ever been to was years and years ago at Anaheim, California.
Yeah,
they don't
okay.
come out west anymore because it's too far to come, and I understand that. And I saw Tom there. They had a Sports Collector's Digest booth. And I went up to him. I said, hey, thanks for – the first interview I sent him was with Warren Sandell, who never played in the major leagues but played for the minor leagues, New York Giants. And he was the first
yeah.
one
yeah.
to Jackie Robinson in white organized baseball. And I sent hmm. that in, and he published it. And so I went up to him, and I said, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. And he goes, hey, we appreciate you. Keep those interviews coming. And very nice man. And then he left later on to go to some other publication. But
Right.
Yeah.
So about the book, buy your book? No problem.
I'm sorry. They can click on Amazon.com, either Los Angeles Rams books or Rick Van Blair books, and it should pop up. And thanks to Martin Jacobs, who I know you know, he talked me in. I called him up one day, and I says, gosh, your Kezar Stadium book is fantastic. I love it. And I told him about my book, but it was rejected by two or three publishers, and I just got disgusted, and I threw it in the corner, and it sat there for a few years. He goes, go self-publish, Rick. Go ahead and do it. And so I did it. And now I'm on the with a sign saying, need money to pay for it. No, I'm just kidding. Martin is it's on Amazon.com right now, and it's priced at $18.98 so that most people could afford it. And it's not a gigantic book. It's not 300 or 400 pages, because I know a lot of people, and I do too. I pick up a book that's 400 pages, and I go, oh, God, it's going to take me forever to get through this thing. No, it's 202 pages, got photos in it.
I
you
read
see,
it.
And, oh, the cover's fantastic.
I read it. I read the book in what I read your book in one night. I loved it. I'm going to review it in the fall issue of Gridiron Greeks magazine, and I do highly recommend it. And we're going to have an ad for you for the next issue too for that. But it is a great book. I enjoyed it, and I learned a lot from it. Unfortunately, we're literally almost out of time, Dick. Any final thoughts in 30 seconds or less?
Oh. Where would we be? Where would the human race be without sports? Really? I mean, it's so much fun when we were kids to play them and look up and have heroes. It's so much fun collecting this stuff. I never collected a whole lot of baseball cards. I didn't think they'd be worth anything. Matter of fact, I had 8 or 9 Willie Mays. He was one of my favorite players as a kid. I had a scrapbook I made of Willie, and I glued them into the scrapbook. What an idiot I was as a kid, because now they're basically worthless. But I would tell kids, don't collect because you think it might get you a lot of money maybe 10 years from now. Collect what you love. Collect what you like. That's the fun of it. It really is.
Yep.
That's the fun of it. I look at these pictures now,
true.
And they bring back so many memories. It's just wonderful, really. Collecting
Dick,
Dick, we're literally out of time. I want to thank you for being on. And
thank you.
I'm sure you're going to get some sales from our podcast and the magazine. Joe,
Gridiron Bump,
we'll be back very soon with another show. And we are definitely out of time. Thanks for listening.
Anytime. Rick, thank you so much.
We've never had a guest run us out of time. You're the first. Thank you.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.